Chapter 22. Irving. Latitude 70 degrees, 5 minutes north. Longitude 98 degrees, 23 minutes west. 13 December, 1847. Third Lieutenant John Irving needed to know how Silence got on and off the ship without being seen. Tonight, 1 month to the day since he'd first found the Eskimo woman in her lair, he would solve the puzzle if it cost him his toes and fingers. The day after he first found her, Irving reported to his captain that the Eskimo woman had moved her den to the forward cable locker on the hold deck. He did not report that she appeared to be eating fresh meat in there, mostly because he doubted what he'd seen in that terrifying second of staring into the small flame-lit space. Nor had he reported the apparent sodomy he'd interrupted in the hold between Calker's mate Hickey and Seaman Manson. Irving knew that he was abrogating his professional duty as an officer in the Royal Navy's Discovery Service by not informing his captain of this shocking and important fact. But what? All John Irving could think of as a reason for his serious breach of duty was that HMS Terror had enough rats aboard it already. But Lady Silence's apparently magical appearances and disappearances, although accepted by the superstitious crew as final evidence of her witchcraft, and ignored by Captain Crozier and the other officers as a myth, seemed far more important to young Irving than whether a Calker's mate and shipboard idiot were pleasuring each other in the stinking darkness of the hold. And it was a stinking darkness, thought Irving, in the third hour of his watch, crouched on a crate above the slush and behind a pillar near the forward cable locker. The stench in the freezing, dark hold was getting worse by the day. At least there were no more half-eaten plates of food, tots of rum, or pagan fetishes on the low platform outside the cable locker. One of the other officers had brought this practice to Crozier's attention after Mr. Blankey's amazing escape from the thing on the ice, and the captain had flown into a fury, threatening to cut off the rum ration forever of the next man stupid enough, superstitious enough, addle-brained enough, and generally unchristian enough to offer up scraps of food or mugs of perfectly good watered-down Indian rum to a native woman, a heathen child. Although those sailors who had gained a peek of Lady Silence naked, or heard the surgeons discussing her, knew that she was no child, and muttered as much to one another. Captain Crozier had also made it completely clear that he would tolerate no show of white bear fetishes. He announced at the previous day's divine service, actually a reading of ship's articles, although many of the men were eager for more words from the Book of Leviathan, that he would add one extra late-night watch or two seats of ease thunder jar disposal duties to each man for every single bear tooth, bear claw, bear tail, new tattoo, or other fetish item he saw on that hapless sailor. Suddenly the enthusiasm for pagan fetishes became invisible on HMS Terror, although Lieutenant Irving heard from his friends on Erebus that it was still thriving there. Several times, Irving had tried to follow the Eskimo in her furtive movements around the ship at night, but, not wanting her to know that he was following her, he had lost her. Tonight he knew that Lady Silence was in her locker. He had followed her down the main ladder more than 3 hours ago, after the men's supper, and then, after she had quietly and almost invisibly received her portion of poor John, cod and a biscuit, and glass of water from Mr. Diggle and gone below with it. Irving posted a man at the forward hatch, just forward of the huge stove, and another curious sailor to watch the main ladderway. He arranged for these watches to trade off every 4 hours. If the Eskimo woman climbed either ladder tonight, it was already past 10 p.m, Irving would know where she went and when. But for 3 hours now, the cable locker doors had been tightly shut. The only illumination in this forward part of the hold had been the slightest leakage of light around the edges of those low, wide locker doors. The woman still had some source of illumination in there, either a candle or other open flame. This fact alone would cause Captain Crozier to have her plucked out of the cable locker in a minute and returned to her little den in the storage area, forward of the lower deck sickbay, or thrown out onto the ice. The captain feared fire in the ship as much as any other veteran sailor, and he seemed to harbour no sentimental feelings toward their Eskimo guest. Suddenly, the dim rectangle of light around the ill-fitted locker door disappeared. "She's gone to sleep," thought Irving. He could imagine her, naked, just as he'd seen her, pulling her cocoon of furs around her in there. Irving could also imagine one of the other officers hunting for him in the morning and finding his lifeless body curled here on a crate above the slush-flooded hull, obviously an ungentlemanly cad who had frozen to death while trying to sneak a peek at the only woman on board. It would not be an heroic death report for Lieutenant John Irving's poor parents to read. At that moment, a veritable breeze of icy air moved through the already frigid hold. It was as if a malevolent spirit had brushed past him in the darkness. For a second, Irving felt the hairs on the back of his neck rise up, but then a simple thought struck him. "It's just a draft, as if someone has opened a door or window." He knew then how Lady Silence magically came and went from the terror. Irving lit his own lantern, jumped off the crate, splashed through the sludge slush, and tugged at the doors of the cable locker. They were secured from the inside. Irving knew that there was no lock inside the forward cable locker. There wasn't even a lock on the outside, since no one had any reason to attempt to steal cable houses. So therefore, the native woman herself had found a way to secure it. Irving had prepared for this contingency. He carried a 30-inch pry bar in his right hand, knowing that he would have to explain any damage to Lieutenant Little and possibly to Captain Crozier. He jammed the narrow end of the bar in the crack between the 3-foot-high doors and leveraged hard. There came a creaking and groaning, but the doors opened only an inch or two. Still holding the pry bar in place with one hand, Irving reached under his slops, greatcoat, undercoat, and waistcoat and pulled his boat knife from his belt. Lady Silence had somehow driven nails into the backsides of the cable locker doors and run some sort of elastic rawhide material, gut, sinew, back and forth, until the doors were secured as if by a white spiderweb. There was no way that Irving could enter now without leaving a clear trace that he'd been there. The pry bar had already seen to that, so he used the knife to slash through the cat's cradle of sinew. It was not easy. The strands of sinew were more resistant to the sharp blade than rawhide or ship's rope. When the strands finally fell away, Irving extended the hissing lantern into the low space. The little cave den he'd seen 4 weeks earlier was, except for the absence of any flame now other than his lanterns, just as he remembered. The coiled houses pushed back and pulled almost overhead to create a sort of cave within the raised locker area. And there were the same signs that she'd been eating meals there, one of Terra's pewter plates with only a few crumbs of poor John remaining on it, a pewter grog mug and some sort of storage bag that looked as if Silence had stitched it together from scraps of discarded sail canvas. Also on the locker deck was one of the ship's small oil lanterns, the kind with just enough oil in it for the men to use when going above to one of the seats of ease at night. Its flue was still very warm to the touch when Irving removed his mitten and glove. But no Lady Silence. Irving could have tugged and jerked the heavy houses this way and that to look behind them, but he knew from experience that the rest of the triangular cable locker space was crammed tight with the anchor ropes. 2.5 years since they had sailed, and they still carried the stink of the Thames on them. But Lady Silence was gone. There was no way up through the deck and beams above or out through the hull. So, were the superstitious seamen correct? Was she an Eskimo witch, a she-shaman, a pagan sorcerer? Third Lieutenant John Irving did not believe it. He noticed that the active breeze was no longer flowing around him, yet the flame of his lantern still danced to some smaller draft. Irving moved the lantern around at arm's length. That was all the free space there was in the crowded and cramped hawser locker, and stopped when the lamp flame danced the most, forward, just starboard of the apex of the bow. He set the lantern down and began moving hawser aside. Immediately, Irving saw how cleverly she had arranged the massive anchor line here. What appeared to be another huge coil of Hauser was merely a curled section of another coil set into an empty space to simulate a stack of Hauser, easy to pull aside into her den space. Behind the faux Hauser coil was the curve of wide hull timbers. Once again, she had chosen carefully. Above and beneath the cable locker ran a complex webbing of wood and iron beams, set in place during HMS Terra's refitting for ice service some months before the expedition sailed. Up here by the bow, there were iron vertical beams, oak crossbeams, triple-thick support struts, iron triangular supports, and huge oak diagonal beams, many as thick as primary hull timbers, lacing back and forth as part of the ship's modern design reinforcement for the polar ice. One London reporter, Lieutenant Irving knew, had described all the tons of iron and oak internal reinforcements, as well as the addition of African oak, Canadian elm, and more African oak to the English oak on the sides of the hull, as being enough to make a mass of timber about 8 feet thick. That was almost literally true for the actual bow and for the sides of the hull, Irving knew. But here, where the last 5 feet or so of hull timber met at the bow in and above the cable locker, there were only the original 6 inches of stout English oak for the hull boards, rather than the 10 inches of layered hardwoods found elsewhere along both sides of the hull. It was thought that the areas a few feet to the immediate port and starboard of the heavily reinforced bow stem would have to be of fewer layers in order to flex during the terrible stresses of ice breaking. And so they had. The 5 belts of lumber at the sides of the hull, combined with the iron and oak reinforced bow and internal areas, had produced a marvel of modern ice-breaking technology that no other navy or civilian expedition service in the world could match. Terra and Erebus had gone places where no other ice ship on Earth could hope to survive. This bow area was a marvel, but it was no longer secure. It took Irving several minutes to find it, extending the lantern for drafts and feeling with his freezing bare fingers and probing with his knife blade to see where a 3-foot section of the 1.5-foot wide hull timber had been loosened. There, the aft end of the single curved board was secured by 2 long nails that now worked as a sort of hinge. The forward end, only a few feet from the huge bow and keel timber that ran the length of the ship, had been only pressed into place. Working the hull timber loose with the pry bar, wondering how on earth the young woman could have done this with only her fingers, and then letting it drop, Irving felt the blast of cold air and found himself looking into darkness through an 18-inch by 3-foot gap in the hull. This was impossible. The young lieutenant knew that Terra's bows had been armored for 20 feet back from their stems with inch-thick rolled and tempered plates of specially fitted sheet iron. Even if an internal timber were somehow dislodged, the ship's bow areas, for almost a third of the way aft, were armor-plated. Not now. The cold blew in from ice-black cave darkness beyond the dislodged plank. This part of the bow had been forced under the ice by the ship's constant tilt forward as ice built under Terra's stern. Lieutenant Irving's heart pounded furiously. If Terra were to be refloated miraculously tomorrow, she would sink. Could Lady Silence have done this to the ship? The thought terrified Irving more than any belief in her magical ability to appear and disappear at will. Could a young woman, not yet 20 years old, rip iron hull plates off a ship? Dislodge heavy bow timbers that it had taken a shipyard to bend and nail into place, and know exactly where to do all this, so 60 men aboard who knew the ship better than their mothers' faces would not notice? Already on his knees in the low place, Irving found that he was breathing through his open mouth, his heart still pounding. He had to believe that Terra's 2 summers of wild battle with the ice, across Baffin Bay, through Lancaster Sound, all the way around Cornwallis Island before the winter at Beachy Island, the next summer crashing south down the Sound, and then through what the men were now calling Franklin's Strait. Somewhere there toward the end, some of the iron bow armour below the waterline must have been dislodged, and this thick hull timber displaced inward only after the ice had seized the ship in its grasp. But could something other than the ice have loosened the oak hull timber? Was it something else? Something trying to get in? It didn't matter now. Lady Silence could not have been gone more than a few minutes, and John Irving was dedicated to following her, not only to see where she went out there in the darkness, but to see if, somehow, impossibly, miraculously, given the thickness of the ice and the terrible cold, she was finding and killing her own fresh fish or game. If she was, Irving knew, this fact might save them all. Lieutenant Irving had heard what the others had heard about the spoilage in the Goldner canned stores. Everyone aboard both ships had heard the whispers that they would be out of provisions before next summer. He couldn't fit through the hole. Irving pried at the surrounding hull timbers, but everything save for this one hinged board was rock solid. This 18-inch by 3-foot gap in the hull was the only way out, and he was too bulky. He stripped off his oilskin slops, his heavy greatcoat, his comforter, cap, and Welsh wig, and shoved them through the gap ahead of him. He was still too wide in the shoulders and upper body, although he was one of the thinnest officers aboard. Shaking from the cold, Irving unbuttoned his waistcoat and the wool sweater he wore under that, shoving them through the black aperture as well. If he couldn't get out through the hull now, he'd have the devil's own time explaining why he came back up from the hold, minus all of his outer layers. He did fit, just barely. Grunting and cursing, Irving squeezed through the tight space, buttons tearing off his wool shirt. "I'm outside the ship, under the ice," he thought. The idea did not seem quite real. He was in a narrow cave in the ice that had built up around the bow and bowsprit. There was no room for him to get back into his coats and clothes, so he pushed them on ahead of him. He considered reaching back into the cable locker for the lantern, but a full moon had been in the sky when he'd been officer on watch a few hours earlier. In the end, he took the metal pry bar instead. The ice cave must have been at least as long as the bowsprit, more than 18 feet, and indeed may have been created by the heavy bowsprit beams working of the ice here during the brief thaw and freeze cycles of the previous summer. When Irving finally emerged from the tunnel, it took him a few extra seconds of crawling before he realized that he was out. The thin bowsprit, its mass of lashed rigging and curtains of frozen jib shrouds, still loomed over him, blocking, he realized, not only his view of the sky, but also any chance for the man on bow watch to see him. And out here, beyond the bowsprit, with terror only a huge black silhouette looming above, the ice illuminated only by a few thin lantern beams, the way forward continued into and through the jumble of ice blocks and seracs. Shaking hard, Irving tugged on his various layers. His hands were shaking too fiercely for him to button his wool waistcoat, but that didn't matter. The greatcoat was hard to pull on, but at least the buttons were much larger. By the time he had his oil slops on, the young lieutenant was frozen to the bone. Which way? The ice jumble here, 50 feet beyond the ship's bow, was a forest of ice boulders and wind-sculpted seracs. Silence could have gone in any direction, but the ice seemed worn down in a roughly straight line out from the ice tunnel into the ship. At the very least, it offered the path of least resistance, and most concealment, away from the ship. Getting to his feet, lifting the pry bar in his right hand, Irving followed the slippery ice trough toward the west. He would never have found her had it not been for the unearthly sound. He was several hundred yards from the ship now, lost in the ice maze. The blue ice trough underfoot had long since disappeared, or rather been joined by a score of other such grooves. And although the light from the full moon and stars illuminated everything as if it were day, he had seen no movement nor footprints in the snow. Then, came the unearthly wailing. No, he realized, stopping in his tracks and trembling all over. He had been shaking from the cold for many minutes, but now the trembling went deeper. This was not wailing, not of the sort a human being can make. This was the amelodic playing of some infinitely strange musical instrument, part muffled bagpipe, part horn hoot, part oboe, part flute, part human chant. It was loud enough for him to hear dozens of yards away, but almost certainly not audible on the deck of the ship, especially since the wind, most unusually, was blowing from the southeast this night. Yet all the tones were one blended sound from one instrument. Irving had never heard anything like it. The playing, which seemed to begin suddenly, increase its rhythm almost sexually, and then stop abruptly, as if in physical climax, and not in the least as if someone was following notes on a sheet of music, was coming from a serac field near a high-pressure ridge less than 30 yards to the north of the torch cairn path Captain Crozier insisted on maintaining between Terra and Erebus. No one was working on the cairns tonight. Irving had the frozen ocean to himself. To himself, and to whoever or whatever was producing that music. He crept through the blue-lit maze of ice boulders and tall seracs. Whenever he became disoriented, he would look up at the full moon. The yellow orb looked more like another full-sized planet, suddenly looming in the starlit sky than like any moon Irving remembered from his years ashore or brief assignments at sea. The air around it seemed to quake with the cold, as if the atmosphere itself were on the verge of freezing solid. Ice crystals in the upper air had created a huge double halo encircling the moon, the lower bands of both circles invisible behind the pressure ridge and icebergs roundabout. Set around the outer halo, like diamonds on a silver ring, were three bright glowing crosses. The lieutenant had seen this phenomenon several times before this, during their night winters up here near the North Pole. Ice Master Blanky had explained that it was just the moonlight refracting off ice crystals the way a light would through a diamond, but it added to Irving's sense of religious awe and wonder here in the blue glowing ice field as that odd instrument began hooting and moaning again, just yards away behind the ice now, its tempo again hurrying to an almost ecstatic pace before suddenly breaking off. Irving tried to imagine Lady Silence playing some hitherto unseen Eskimo instrument, some caribou antler variation on a Bavarian flugelhorn, say. But he rejected the idea as silly. First of all, she and the man who had died had arrived with no such instrument. And second, Irving had the strangest feeling that it was not Lady Silence who was playing this unseen instrument. Crawling over the last low-pressure ridge between him and the seracs, from whence the sound was coming, Irving continued forward, on all fours, not wanting the crunch of his lug-soled boots to be heard on the hard ice or soft snow. The hooting, seemingly just behind the next blue-glowing serac, this one carved by wind into something like a thick flag, had begun again, rising quickly to the loudest, fastest, deepest, and most frenzied noise Irving had heard so far. To his amazement, he found that he had an erection. Something about this instrument's deep, booming, reed-fluttering sound was so primal that it quite literally stirred his loins, even as he shivered. He peered around the last serac. Lady Silence was about 20 feet away across a smooth, blue ice space. Seracs and ice boulders circled the spot, making Irving feel as if he'd suddenly found himself amid a Stonehenge circle in the ice-haloed and star-crossed moonlight. Even the shadows here were blue. She was naked, kneeling on thick furs that must be her parka. Her back was in three-quarters profile to Irving, and while he could see the curve of her right breast, he could also see the bright moonlight illuminating her long, straight black hair and setting silver highlights on the hillocked flesh of her firm backside. Irving's heart was pounding so hard, that he was afraid she might hear it. Silence was not alone. Something else filled the dark gap between druidic ice boulders on the opposite side of the clearing, just beyond the Eskimo woman. Irving knew it was the thing from the ice. White bear or white demon, it was here with them, almost atop the young woman, looming over her. As much as the lieutenant strained his eyes, it was hard to make out the shape. White blue fur against white blue ice, heavy muscles against heavy ridges of snow and ice, black eyes that might or might not be separate from the absolute blackness behind the thing. The triangular head on the strangely long bare neck was weaving and bobbing like a snake, he saw now, 6 feet above and beyond the kneeling woman. Irving tried to estimate the size of the creature's head for future reference in terms of killing it, but it was impossible to isolate the precise shape or size of the triangular mass with its coal black eyes because of its odd and constant movement. But the thing was looming over the girl. Its head was almost directly above her now. Irving knew that he should cry out, rush forward with the pry bar in his mittened hand, since he had brought no other weapon except for his resheathed ship's knife, and try to save the woman. But his muscles would not have obeyed such a command at that moment. It was everything he could do to keep watching in a sort of sexually excited horror. Lady Silence had extended her arms, palms up, like a popish priest saying mass and inviting the miracle of the Eucharist. Irving had a cousin in Ireland who was popish, and he'd actually gone to a Catholic service with him once during a visit. The same sense of strange, magical ceremony was being played out here in the blue moonlight. Silence, without a tongue, made no noise, but her arms were thrown wide. Her eyes were closed. Her head was thrown back. Irving had crawled far enough forward that he could see her face now, and her mouth was open and wide, like a supplicant awaiting communion. The creature's neck thrust forward and down as quickly as a cobra's strike, and the thing's jaws opened wide and seemed to snap shut on Lady Silence's lower face, devouring half her head. Irving almost screamed then, only the ceremonial heaviness of the moment and his own incapacitating fear kept him silent. The thing had not devoured her. Irving realized that he was looking at the top of the monster's blue-white head, a head at least 3 times larger than the woman's, as it had closed but not snapped shut, its giant jaws fitting over her open mouth and upthrust jaw. Her arms were still flung wide to the night, almost as if ready to embrace the gigantic mass of hair and muscle enfolding her. The music began then. Irving saw the bobbing of both heads, creatures and Eskimos, but it took him half a minute before he realized that the orgiastic bass hootings and erotic bagpipe flute notes were emanating from the woman. The monstrous thing, looming as large as the ice boulders beside it, white bear or demon, was blowing down into her open mouth, playing her vocal cords as if her human throat were a reed instrument. The trills and low notes and bass resonances came louder, faster, more urgently. He saw Lady Silence raise her head and bend her neck one way, while the serpentine-necked, triangular-headed bear thing above her bent its head and neck in the opposite direction, the two looking like nothing so much as lovers, straining to plunge deeper, while seeking to find the best and deepest angle for a passionate, open-mouthed kiss. The musical notes pounded faster and faster. Irving was sure that the rhythm must be heard on the ship now, must be giving every man on the ship as powerful and permanent an erection as he was suffering at this second. And then suddenly, without warning, the noise cut off with the suddenness of the climax of wild lovemaking. The thing's head reared up and back. The white neck bobbed and coiled. Lady Silence's arms dropped to her naked sides, as if she was too exhausted or transported to hold them out any longer. Her head lolled forward over her moon-silvered breasts. It will devour her now, thought Irving, through all the insulating layers of numbness and disbelief at what he had just seen. It will rend and eat her now. It did not. For a second, the bobbing white mass was gone, shuffled swiftly away on all fours through the blue Stonehenge of ice pillars, and then it was back, bowing its head low before Lady Silence, dropping something onto the ice in front of her. Irving could hear the noise of something organic hitting the ice, and the smack had a familiar ring to it. But right now, nothing was in context. Irving could make sense of nothing he saw or heard. The white thing ambled away again. Irving could feel the impact of its huge feet through the solid sea ice. In a minute, it was back, dropping something else in front of the Eskimo girl. Then a third time. And then it was simply gone, blended back into the darkness. The young woman was kneeling alone in the ice clearing, with only the low heap of dark shapes in front of her. She remained that way for another minute. Irving thought of his distant Irish cousin's Popish church again, and the old parishioners who stayed praying in their pews after the service had finished. Then she got to her feet, quickly slipping her bare feet into fur boots and pulling on her fur pants and parka. Lieutenant Irving realized that he was shaking wildly. At least part of that was from the cold, he knew. He'd be lucky if he had enough warmth in him and strength in his legs to get back to the ship alive. He had no idea how the girl had survived her nakedness. Silence swept up the objects the thing had dropped in front of her and was now carrying them carefully in her fur parka arms, the way a woman would carry one or more infants still suckling at her breast. She seemed to be heading back to the ship, crossing the clearing to a point between the Stonehenge seracs about 10 degrees to his left. Suddenly she stopped, her hooded head turning in his direction, and although he could not see her black eyes, he could feel her gaze boring into him. Still on all fours, he realized that he was in full sight in the bright moonlight, 3 feet away from the concealment of any serac. In his absolute need to get a better view, he had forgotten to stay hidden. For a long moment, neither of them moved. Irving could not breathe. He waited for her motion, a slapping of ice perhaps, and then for the quick return of the thing from the ice, her protector, her avenger, his destroyer. Her hooded gaze moved away, and she walked on, disappearing between the ice pillars on the southeast side of the circle. Irving waited another several minutes, still shaking, as if from ague, and then he struggled to his feet. His body was frozen through, its only sensation coming from his now detumescing, burning erection, and from his uncontrollable shaking. But instead of staggering toward the ship after the girl, he moved forward to where she had knelt in the moonlight. There was blood on the ice. The stains were black in the bright blue moonlight. Lieutenant Irving knelt, tugged off his mitten and underglove, set some of the spreading stain to his finger, and tasted it. It was blood, but he did not think it was human blood. The thing had brought her raw, warm, freshly killed meat, some sort of flesh. The blood tasted coppery to Irving, the way his own blood or any human blood would, but he assumed that freshly killed animals also had such coppery-tasting blood. But what animal? And from where? The men of the Franklin expedition had seen no land animals for more than a year. Blood freezes in a few fast minutes. This thing had killed its gift to Lady Silence only minutes ago, even as Irving had been stumbling around out here in the ice maze trying to find her. Backing away from the black stain in the moonlit snow, the way he might back away from a pagan stone altar where some innocent victim had just been sacrificed, Irving concentrated first on trying to breathe normally. The air was ripping at his lungs as he gasped. And then, on urging his frozen legs and numbed mind to get him back to the ship, he would not try going in through the ice tunnel and loose-planked the cable locker. He would hail the starboard lookout before he got in shotgun range and walk up the ice ramp like a man, answering no questions until he spoke to the captain. Would he tell the captain about this? Irving had no idea. He didn't even know if the thing on the ice, which must still be nearby, would let him return to the ship. He didn't know if he had the warmth and energy remaining for the long walk. He only knew that he would never be the same again. Irving turned to the southeast and re-entered the forest of ice. Chapter 23. Hickey. Latitude 70 degrees, 5 minutes north. Longitude 98 degrees, 23 minutes west. 18 December, 1847. Hickey had decided that the tall, skinny lieutenant, Irving, had to die, and that today was the day to do it. The diminutive Calker's mate had nothing personal against the naive young toff, other than his poor timing in the hold more than a month earlier, but that was enough to swing the scales against Irving. Work and watch schedules kept Hickey from his task. Twice he had rotated onto watch duties when Irving was officer on deck, but Magnus Manson had not been on duty above decks either time. Hickey would plan the timing and method of the deed, but he needed Magnus for the execution. It was not that Cornelius Hickey was afraid of killing a man. He'd cut a man's throat before he was old enough to go into a whorehouse without a sponsor. No, it was simply the means and method that this murder called for, which required his idiot disciple and arsefuck buddy on this expedition, Magnus Manson. Now, all the conditions were perfect. It was a Friday morning work party, although morning meant little when it was as dark out as midnight. With more than 30 men out on the ice, repairing and improving the torch cairns between Terra and Erebus. 9 musket-armed marines were, in theory, providing security for the work parties. But in truth, the line of working men was spread out for almost a mile, with only 5 men or fewer under the command of each officer. The 3 officers here in the east half of the dark cairn trail were from Terra, Lieutenants Little, Hodgson, and Irving. And Hickey had helped sort the work parties so that he and Magnus were working on the farthest cairns under Irving. The Marines were out of sight most of the time, supposedly prepared to come running should there be an alarm, but really just doing their best to stay warm near the fire roaring in the iron brazier, set up near the highest pressure ridge less than a quarter mile from the ship. John Bates and Bill Sinclair were also working under Lieutenant Irving this morning, but the two were chums and lazy and tended to stay out of the young officer's sight so they could work at the next ice cairn as slowly as they pleased. The day, though dark as night, was not as cold as some recently, perhaps only 45 below out, and almost windless. There was no moon or aurora, but the stars vibrated in the morning sky, shedding enough light that if a man had to walk out of the range of a lantern or torch, he could see well enough to make his way back. With the thing on the ice still out there in the darkness somewhere, not many men wandered far. Still, the very nature of finding and stacking the correctly sized ice chips and blocks to repair and enlarge a proper 5-foot-tall cairn required the men to keep wandering in and out of the lantern light. Irving was checking on both cairns, while frequently giving the men a hand with the physical labor. Hickey only had to wait until Bates and Sinclair were out of sight beyond the curve in the trail through the ice blocks, and Lieutenant Irving's guard was down. The Calker's mate could have used 100 iron or steel instruments from the ship. A Royal Navy vessel was a treasure trove of murder weapons, some of them quite ingenious. But he preferred that Magnus simply blindside the blonde-haired dandy of an officer, haul him off 20 yards or so into the ice, break his neck, then, when he was well and truly dead, rip some of the toff's clothing off, smash in his ribs, kick in his pink-cheeked, happy face and teeth, break an arm and 2 legs, or a leg and 2 arms, and leave the corpse there on the ice to be found. Hickey had already chosen the killing ground, an area of tall seracs, and with no snow underfoot in which Manson would leave boot prints. He'd warned Magnus not to get the lieutenant's blood on him, not to leave any sign that he'd been there with him, and most important, not to take time to rob the man. The thing on the ice had killed men with about every variation of violence imaginable, and if the physical damage to poor Lieutenant Irving was vicious enough, no one on either ship would give a second thought as to what happened. Lieutenant John Irving would be just another canvas-wrapped corpse for Terror's dead room. Magnus Manson was not a born killer, just a born idiot. But he'd murdered men for his Calker's mate, lord and master before. It would not bother him to do so again. Cornelius Hickey doubted that Magnus would even ask himself why the lieutenant had to die. It was just another order from his master to be obeyed. So Hickey was surprised when the physical giant pulled him aside, when Lieutenant Irving was out of earshot, and whispered with some urgency,
"His ghost won't haunt me, will it, Cornelius?"
Hickey patted his huge partner on the back. "Of course not, Magnus. I wouldn't tell you to do nothing that led to having a ghost haunt you. Now would I, love?"
"No, no,"
rumbled Manson, shaking his head in agreement. His wild hair and beard seemed to leap out from under the wool comforter and Welsh wig. His heavy brow furrowed.
"But why won't his ghost haunt me, Cornelius? Me killing him while not having nothing against him and all?"
Hickey thought fast. Bates and Sinclair were walking farther on to where a work party from Erebus was erecting a snowblock fence along a 20-yard stretch where the wind always blew. More than one man had gotten lost in whiteouts there, and the captains thought that a snow fence would improve the courier's chances of finding the next cairns. Irving would make sure that Bates and Sinclair were busy on their task there, and then he'd walk back to where he and Magnus were working alone on the last cairn before the clearing.
"That's why the lieutenant's ghost won't haunt you, Magnus," he whispered to the stooping giant. "You kill the man in heat of temper. Now that's a reason for that man's ghost to come back and try to get even with you. It resents what you did. But Mr. Irving's ghost now, it'll know there was nothing personal in what you had to do, Magnus. It won't have no reason to come back to bother you."
Manson nodded, but did not look completely convinced.
"Besides," continued Hickey, "the ghost won't be able to find its sodding way back to the ship now, will it? Everyone knows that when someone dies outside here, so far from the ship, the ghost goes straight up. It can't figure its way through all the ice ridges and bergs and such. Ghosts ain't the smartest blokes around, Magnus. Take my word on that, my love."
The huge man brightened at hearing this. Hickey could see Irving returning through the torch-lit gloom. The wind was coming up and causing the torch flames to dance wildly.
"Better if there's wind," thought Hickey. "If Magnus or Irving make some noise, no one'll hear."
"Cornelius," whispered Manson.
He looked worried again.
"If I die out here, does that mean my ghost won't be able to find its way back to the ship? I'd hate to be out here in the cold so far away from you."
The Calker's mate patted the slop-shrouded wall of the giant's back.
"You ain't going to die out here, love. You have my solemn promise as a Mason and a Christian on that. Now hush and get ready. When I take off my cap and scratch my head, you grab Irving from behind and drag him to where I showed you. Remember, don't leave no boot prints behind and don't get no blood on you."
"I won't, Cornelius."
"That's a good love."
The lieutenant came closer in the darkness, moving into the dim circle of light thrown by the lantern on the ice here near the cairn.
"Almost finished with this cairn, Mr. Hickey?"
"Aye, sir. Just set these last blocks up here and it's done, Lieutenant. Solid as a lamppost in Mayfair."
Irving nodded. He seemed to be uncomfortable to be alone with the two seamen, even though Hickey was using his most affable and charming voice.
"Well, fuck you,"
thought the Calker's mate, as he continued to show his gap-toothed smile.
"You ain't going to be around much longer to put on such dandified airs, you blonde-haired apple-cheeked bastard. 5 minutes and you'll be just another frozen side of beef to hang down in the hold boil. Too bad them rats are so hungry these days that they'll eat even a fucking lieutenant. But nothing I can do about that.
Very good, said Irving. When you and Manson are finished, please join Mr. Sinclair and Mr. Bates on working on the wall. I'm going to walk back and bring up Corporal Hedges with his musket.
Aye, sir,
said Hickey. He caught Magnus's eye. They had to intercept Irving before he walked back along the dimly visible line of torches and lanterns. It would do no good to have Hedges or another marine up here. Irving walked to the east, but paused at the edge of the light, obviously waiting for Hickey to set the last two blocks of ice in place at the top of the rebuilt cairn. As the Kalka's mate bent to lift the penultimate square of ice, he nodded to Magnus. His partner had moved into position behind the lieutenant. Suddenly, there was an explosion of shouts from the darkness to the west. A man screamed. More voices joined in the shouting. Magnus's huge hands were hovering just behind the lieutenant's neck. The big man had removed his mittens for a better grip, and his undergloves loomed black just beyond Irving's pale face in the lantern light. More shouts. A musket fired.
Magnus! No!
Shouted Cornelius Hickey. His partner had been about to break Irving's neck despite the commotion. Manson stepped back into the darkness. Irving, who had taken 3 steps toward the shouting in the west, whirled in confusion. 3 men came running along the ice path from the direction of terror. One of them was Hedges. The roly-poly marine was wheezing as he ran, his musket held in front of his massive bulge of belly.
Come,
said Irving, and led the way toward the shouting. The lieutenant was carrying no weapon, but he'd grabbed up the lantern. The 6 of them ran across the sea ice, out of the seracs, into the starlit clearing where several men were milling. Hickey could make out the familiar Welsh wigs of Sinclair and Bates, and recognized one of the 3 Erebuses already there as Francis Dunn, his Kalka's mate counterpart on the other ship. He saw that the musket that had fired belonged to Private Bill Pilkington, who'd been in the hunting blind when Sir John was killed last June, and who had been shot in the shoulder by one of his fellow Marines during those moments of chaos. Now, Pilkington was reloading and then aiming the long musket into the darkness beyond a fallen section of the snow fence wall.
What has happened?
Irving demanded of the men. Bates answered. He, Sinclair and Dunn, as well as Abraham Seeley and Josephus Greater from Erebus, had been working on the wall under the command of Erebus's first mate, Robert Orme Sargent, when suddenly one of the larger blocks of ice, just beyond the circle of lantern and torchlights, had seemed to come alive.
It lifted Mr. Sargent 10 feet into the air by his head, said Bates, his voice shaking.
It's the God's truth, said Kalka's mate Francis Dunn. 1 minute he was standing among us. Next minute he's flying up into the air, so all's we can see is the bottom of his boots. And the noise, the crunching.
Dunn broke off and continued breathing hard until his pale face was all but lost in a halo of ice crystals.
I was coming up to the torches when I saw Mr. Sargent just disappear, said Private Pilkington, lowering the musket with shaking arms. I fired once as the thing went back into the seracs. I think I hit it.
You could have hit Robert Sargent just as easily, said Cornelius Hickey. Maybe he was alive when you shot.
Pilkington gave Terror's Kalka's mate a look of pure venom.
Mr. Sargent wasn't alive, said Dunn, not even noticing the exchange of glares between the Marine and Hickey. He screamed once, and the thing crunched his skull like a walnut. I seen it. I heard it.
Others came running up then, including Captain Crozier and Captain FitzJames, looking wan and insubstantial, even in his heavy layers of slops and greatcoat. And Dunn, Bates, and the others all rushed to explain what they had seen. Corporal Hedges and 2 other Marines who had run to the commotion returned from the darkness to say there was no sign of Mr. Sargent, only a thick trail of blood and torn clothing that led off into the thicker ice jumble in the direction of the largest iceberg.
It wants us to follow, muttered Bates. It'll be waiting for us.
Crozier showed his teeth in something between a mad grin and a snarl.
Then we won't disappoint it, he said. This is as good a time as any to go after the thing again. We have the men out on the ice already. We have enough lanterns, and the Marines can fetch more muskets and shotguns, and the trail is fresh.
Too fresh, muttered Corporal Hedges.
Crozier barked orders. Some men went back to the two ships to bring the weapons. Others formed up in hunting parties around the Marines, who were already armed. Torches and lanterns were brought from the worksites and assigned to the killing parties. Dr. Stanley and Dr. MacDonald were sent for, in the low probability that Robert Orme Sargent might still be alive, or the higher probability that someone else might be injured. After Hickey was handed a musket, he considered shooting Lieutenant Irving by accident, once out in the dark. But the young officer now seemed wary of both Manson and the caulker's mate. Hickey caught several concerned glances the Toff was throwing toward Magnus before Crozier assigned them to different search parties. And he knew that whether Irving had caught a glimpse of Magnus behind with his arms raised in that second before the shots and shouts were first heard, or whether the officer simply sensed something wrong, it wouldn't be as easy to ambush him next time. But they would. Hickey was afraid that John Irving's suspicions would finally cause him to report to the captain what he'd seen in the hold, and the caulker's mate could not abide that. It wasn't so much the punishment for sodomy that bothered him. Seamen were rarely hanged anymore, nor flogged around the fleet for that matter, but rather the ignominy. Caulker's mate Cornelius Hickey was no mere idiot's bum bugger. He would wait until Irving lowered his guard again, and then do the deed himself if he had to. Even if the ship's surgeons discovered that the man had been murdered, it wouldn't matter. Things had gone too far on this expedition. Irving would be just another corpse to deal with come the thaw. In the end, Mr. Sargent's body was not found. The blood and strewn clothing trail ended halfway to the towering iceberg, but no one else died in the search. A few men lost toes to the cold, and everyone was shaking and frostbitten to some extent when they finally called off the hunt an hour after their supper should have been served. Hickey did not see Lieutenant Irving again that afternoon. It was Magnus Manson who surprised him as they trudged back to Terror again. The wind was beginning to howl at their backs, and the Marines slouched along with rifles and muskets at the ready. Hickey realized that the idiot giant next to him was weeping. The tears instantly froze to Magnus's bearded cheeks.
What is it, man?
Demanded Hickey.
It's sad as all, Cornelius.
What is sad?
Poor Mr. Sargent.
Hickey shot a glance at his partner.
I didn't know you had such tender feelings for them damned officers, Magnus.
I don't, Cornelius. They can all die and be damned for all I care. But Mr. Sargent died out on the ice.
So?
His ghost won't find his way back to the ship. And Captain Crozier passed the word when we was done searching that we're all having an extra tot of rum this evening. Makes me sad his ghost won't be there is all. Mr. Sergeant always liked his rum, Cornelius.